evictions notice. But we know that this is most likely not all units received an eviction, but rather there were some units that actually received multiple evictions notice. And then to also put this into perspective, roughly between 91 and 94% of those evictions were for non-payment of rent. That would give the idea that folks do not want to pay their rent and they're either withholding their rent, but rather after speaking with tenants at this particular property, it's that the rents are vastly unaffordable and they can no longer make some of the sacrifices that they once were able to make in the past. And as a result, they just can't afford the rents that are being charged. And so to put that further into perspective, in the subsequent year in 2020, at the height of the pandemic, Starlight increased rents on new leases by 25.3%. That is about 11 times higher than the rate of inflation for shelter in the province of Ontario for that year, and over 19 times higher than the rate of inflation for the city of Toronto for that year in 2020. And these particular landlords operate on three principles: high rents, high occupancy, and policies that help them to expeditiously remove non-paying tenants that don't fit within their profit maximization strategies.
Well, this has been a super helpful conversation. You know, these questions about housing, they affect us all so directly, so personally. And yet I think a lot of the issues, whether it's for buyers or it's for renters, are not that well understood, and the system is pretty opaque. And you know what I found in our conversation, you really helped pull back the curtain on some of the policies and some of their effects on real people, and I think there's huge value in that. Thank you for listening to the Big Thinking Podcast and to my guest, Nimoy Lewis, assistant professor at the Toronto Metropolitan University. I also want to thank our friends and partners at the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, whose support helps make this podcast possible. Finally, thank you to Cited Media for their support in producing the Big Thinking Podcast. Let us know what you thought of this episode and share your feedback with us on social media. Follow us for more episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and Google Podcast. À la prochaine.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, April 4th, 2025. I'm Breanne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. Working Canadians are facing a multitude of issues in 2025. Between 2023 and 2024, in Ontario alone, 1 million people used food bank services, a 25% increase from the year before. Canada's housing crisis is among the most unaffordable in the world. And of course, the latest crisis on everyone's mind, the ongoing trade dispute with the United States. With a federal election at the end of the month, there's a lot to consider for working Canadians. This week on Rabble Radio, Labour reporter Gabriella Kaluke-Kasuga sits down with Dina Ladd, one of the founders and executive director of the Toronto Workers' Action Centre. The two discuss the issues facing working Canadians today, how workers without union support are often more vulnerable to these issues, and how the Workers' Action Centre advocates for fair work for all. Here is that conversation. Take a listen.
So thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today, Dina.
Pleasure to be here.
And And just to get started, could you introduce yourself and the Workers Action Center for those who may not have heard about it?
Sure. My name's Dina, and I'm the executive director at the Workers Action Center. And so our center is about 20 years old. We've been around in Toronto, but we organize across the GTA. And our center is for non-unionized workers. So workers who don't have representation, who are in part-time jobs, who are in precarious types of jobs, who are working for low wages, who are being mistreated at work. You may look at your paycheck and you think, aren't I supposed to get overtime pay? And so we would be the place for you to phone to not only get your questions answered, but also to sort of help you figure out what to do, you know, because most of us, if we're in a job right now, if we say something, it basically means we're going to lose our jobs because our protections are really not strong, especially in Ontario. So that's what we do. And we're a membership based organization. So many of the workers that call us with their workplace problems then get involved in our center and become leaders in the movement. And so we see ourselves as a huge part of the labor movement in Ontario, fighting for better working conditions and wages.
As we were talking about just before we started this interview, a lot has been happening in Canada lately. So what are kind of some of the main issues that are affecting non-unionized workers right now, and how are they affecting them?
Well, I think at the top of everyone's mind is the tariff crisis right now. I think we have been seeing this unfold, you know, in the last few months. And what is sort of shocking to see is that no one is really talking about the kinds of emergency supports and long-term supports that workers need. There's a sense of, you know, some of the immediate sectors that are being hit, like steel, you know, obviously auto, as of yesterday, the announcements came. But I think that we know, and many economists have been talking about, that it is absolutely those sectors that will be impacted for sure. But there are many other secondary and tertiary sectors that surround those sectors where, you know, you have jobs through the subcontracting and supply chains, you have services and other connected sectors such as hospitality and food services, business services, cleaning services, transportation. So the truck drivers that, for instance, drive the goods across the boundaries of our province and also into the US. I mean, so there are so many impacts on workers that we're not talking about yet. And we have a lot of experience now, I think, since the pandemic, understanding what workers need and what our communities need to ensure that they can actually pay their bills and not lose their housing. And we're not seeing much of that conversation. So I think for us, especially for those who are non-unionized workers, for those workers who don't have union representation through this process and who are seeing the impact, maybe not right now, but maybe 2 or 3 weeks down the road, people are incredibly concerned about what this means. And, you know, economists are also talking about a recession. And we know that that means that if we lose a whole bunch of high paying unionized jobs in our economy, that obviously has an impact on purchasing power, on goods and services, on all of the things that those workers will be buying, which many of our members are working in those other sectors. So it is a very unstable time. And I think people are just trying to figure out what this all means. And this is also in addition to us just going through a provincial election. And now we've also got a federal election in 4 weeks.
Yeah, and I kind of wanted to touch on that election piece. You mentioned, you know, from COVID, we have learned a lot about what workers need when these emergencies come up. How do you feel about, you know, the timing of this election? Do you think it's conducive to bringing in those things that workers need?
I mean, I think that whether it's conducive or not, we're in it. And we have to use this moment. And I think that we have actually the politicians, we have their attention, And I think that we have to make sure that they understand that if they want our vote and if they want the support of our people and our communities, that they actually have to put an agenda that is about dealing with the current crisis that we're in. And it's not just the tariff crisis, right? Like before the tariff crisis even happened, you know, we have some of the worst issues around access to affordable housing. We have a massive affordability crisis right now. We have millions of people who can't even afford to put food on the table. We've got massive food insecurity. We've got people who are going into debt every month, just paying for their basic necessities. We have a shelter system that has no beds, where we've got massive lineups at food banks, where people are not able to get the kinds of services that they need. And that's even before the full impact of the tariff crisis has hit. And so we need to use this moment to push for what our communities need. We need affordable housing built right now, but we also need rent control. We need to put a freeze on rent. We need a moratorium on evictions. Food prices. Why hasn't the government and politicians talking about putting a freeze on the price of food? Why are they not dealing with the price fixing that we know that's happening? And we know that Canadian corporations are going to use this opportunity to increase their prices. We saw this during the pandemic. So why are they not putting in measures to stop the massive profit grab that is going to be happening very soon? And so I think that those are the things that we need to be fighting for, in addition to making sure that everyone has an income security program in place for them under employment insurance. So we know, again, that we need to have an employment insurance system that can protect people when they've lost their jobs or if their hours have decreased. So that program needs to be fully accessible. It needs to also have good rates, not poverty rates. And we need that program to be long enough so that, you know, you're not on it for like 2 or 3 months. I mean, the sectors that are going to be impacted and face job loss, if they're going to pivot and turn around, they can't do it within 3 months. It's going to take a year. It's going to take 2 years. We need to make sure that people have an income to be able to deal with that duration of time that's needed. So there are many things that our communities need. And, you know, I haven't even talked about healthcare and education. So there are many kind of crisis issues that our communities are needing to get addressed and have largely been ignored on these issues. And I think that this is the moment that we have to start putting those issues in their faces and to say, you want our vote? This is what we need. It's not just about the tariff prices. It's about what's going to happen after those tariffs get imposed. And it's about dealing with the issues that are already happening in our communities that are not going to help us be prepared for when those job losses happen.
Yeah, for sure. And like you said, there's a lot of crises going on right now and people need support. So what is the Workers' Action Center doing specifically to kind of organize and really bring attention to these issues, you know, during this election?
Well, we've been sounding the alarm about the fact that we need an employment insurance system that is actually robust and effective and is accessible and is adequate. So we've been sounding the alarm about that. We've launched a campaign called No One Left Behind, and it's about making sure that we can put these measures in place and unite people under some, you know, common demands like the freeze on rent, the freeze on evictions, the freeze on the price of food, the freeze on interest rates so that people are not falling into debt, and then having an income security program that is at least bringing in $600 a week for people to survive on, and making sure that the duration is long enough for people to be able to retrain or pivot and move into another sector of work. So that has been our focus. And we've been trying to sort of say, you know, it's not just employers, because the government has already announced $6 billion for sectors that are impacted, but they're only doing these little tweaks and fixes of employment insurance. And so we find that always our communities and workers, and their families are always thought of last. And we need to organize to make sure that that agenda is front and center. And I think if we think that politicians are going to do that, we are sadly mistaken. We see over and over and over again that we're always thought of as last. And we need to use this moment to make sure that that doesn't happen. And we also need to make sure that people who were essential workers and who are workers in our economy, that immigration status should not be a barrier to accessing emergency supports. That if you are a gig worker or you're misclassified or you're self-employed, which many times you have no control over because that's what your employer demands of you, that they should also be able to access these income supports. And so we want them to be widely accessible for everyone in the labor market. And it shouldn't rely on whether, you know, what your status is as a worker or as a, you know, an immigrant. If you're working, you should have access to it. You're paying into it in many cases, but not able to access it.
Yeah, so it really sounds like part of the work being done here is making workers' interests an election issue, like income supports, for example. I'm curious, you had mentioned earlier in Ontario, this is the second snap election. It's kind of been back to back. How has that affected the energy or the vote intention, I suppose, of members? Have you noticed this like kind of bogging people down at all?
I think in our experience, I think people just didn't vote in the provincial elections. And I think you can see that with the low voter turnout that happened. It's not as bad as 2022, but it's still pretty bad. I think that it happened so fast and within 3 to 4 weeks, I think a lot of people didn't vote. I think a lot of people didn't understand what was going on, why there was an election. I think people were generally like, what's the point? And so I think, unfortunately, people didn't vote. I think that people are a lot more, are paying attention, obviously, to what's happening federally a little bit more because of the tariffs and because of the, you know, economic crisis and threat to the sort of substantial part of, you know, many people's jobs. And I'm hoping that the voter turnout will be high. But I also think that there is a sense that for many workers, I think, you know, we've been seeing that, you know, in some ways you vote, but nothing changes in your life. Right? You are still having a hard time finding decent housing, struggling with the price of food. Many of our members are working 2 or 3 jobs now because of how expensive housing is. And so a lot of people don't have time. A lot of people are working full time and then doing gig work on the side or trying to hustle to try and get income in many different ways. And so I think a lot of people are feeling like when your life doesn't change and, you know, you see all these promises being made by these politicians and then nothing actually really changes substantially, there's not a lot of incentive to vote, to be honest. And then many of the workers we work with don't have the right to vote because they have just PR or they're undocumented. But what we're finding is that they understand the necessity to vote. Because they know what happens when you don't vote. You see the kinds of lack of access to services and things getting a lot worse. So it's a real struggle right now, I think, because people are having such a hard time making ends meet.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I wonder, what would you say to people who are maybe feeling a little disillusioned or they're not feeling that motivation to vote? What would you say to kind of challenge that?
Well, I would say 2 things. I would say, you know, part of getting involved, you know, using these moments when you have politicians' attention, we have to use these moments to push for what our communities need and for what we need and to really hold their feet to the fire and push as hard as we can, because once they get elected, they want to just, you know, again, just go back to what they were doing and ignore all the promises that they made. And so it is, I think, our responsibility to organize like hell right now, because I don't think any politician is going to be thinking, oh, we need to make sure people are are economically surviving during this tariff crisis. We're just not seeing that. We're seeing a lot of conversation around how we can support employers and corporations to survive, but workers are an essential part of how those corporations can exist. We are the labor that makes those corporations tick, and we are the consumers who buy those products. And so if you want us to be buying your products, and if you want to be us to be working, we need some basic standards such as affordable housing and childcare and pharmacare and dental care and all the things that allow us to be able to take care of our kids and pay the rent at the end of the month and put food on the table. And so this is our opportunity to organize for that, because no one else is going to do that for us. And so I would say if anyone is angry or pissed off or worried about what is going on, then you got to organize. You got to make sure that you organize and that they hear what you need and join an organization, join the movement, join the campaign, because otherwise, what's the point, right? We could all just stay at home, or we can organize and make sure that we fight for what we need. And so I would say if anyone's feeling disillusioned, get out there right now and join us to start talking to people and get them organized, because this is the time. We've got 4 weeks. And after that, we've got to really just, as I said before, hold their feet to the fire.
And I like what you mentioned there as well, is the organizing doesn't end when the election's completed. And it sounds like there is a really strong organizing push to really bring these issues to the forefront. So what are like some of the plans to you know, sustain this momentum after the election is over?
Well, at the Workers Action Center, we are about building our community's leadership. So when workers come to the center and they've got a workplace problem, we're not just a service. We sort of really encourage people to then become a member of the center and to get involved and organize in their geographic area or in their language community. And so we have a very active membership. They're from the Bengali community, the Chinese, the Tamil, the Somali, the Latinx community, and they're organizing in different parts of the city. And our members are organizing to provide Know Your Rights workshops, are doing subway leafleting, apartment leafleting, door-to-door, kind of talking to people about the issues that they're experiencing, and then helping them organize against their employers who may not be paying them their fair wages, and also then organizing for better working conditions and against wage theft, which is one of the biggest issues that many non-unionized workers are facing right now, not just even getting paid what you're entitled to, because what we've seen is a deterioration of provincial labor standards, where we've seen the Ministry of Labor not really enforce those rights anymore. And we've seen proactive inspections plummet, prosecutions plummet. It's taking a lot longer for someone's claim to go through. It used to take 3 to 4 months. Now it's taking 6 to 8. Meanwhile, how are you supposed to pay your rent? How are you supposed to take care of your kids if you don't have your wages that you should have been paid in the first place? So these are the kinds of day-to-day realities that our people are facing in their communities. And so we are organizing around that. And I think that when you are organizing around what people need, you know, whether it's housing or workplace issues or health, that is a way of then bringing people into the movement. And I think that that is our biggest challenge, but our biggest opportunity is that if we think that under this current system that we have, whether it's the provincial government or federal government, if we think that doing an email campaign and social media and, you know, having a nice branding campaign and just chatting with people over the phone is going to make a difference, we're sadly mistaken. Like, we really need to get out into the communities that we're working with and have difficult conversations about what people are dealing with, get them involved in our movements and bring people into the organizing. Otherwise, what we're going to have is a lot of people who are alienated and disenfranchised and disaffected and then believing this right-wing populist crap that we're seeing all around us, that is about, you know, we pay too much taxes. Yes, of course we pay too much taxes, but we pay too much taxes in comparison to the corporations who don't even pay their fair share. But taxes are important. What do taxes pay for? These are important conversations, but we can talk about taxes, for instance, in a way that actually shows who's paying and who's not paying, who should be paying, and why is the government letting corporations who are making massive amounts of profit not pay their fair share? Just imagine if those taxes went into our public system and what we could buy in terms of public services and access to issues of healthcare. So those are the kinds of conversations that we need to have. And we need to have them in people's doorsteps and in their living rooms and around the kitchen table. And we've got to challenge the myths where the media and the right-wing politicians like Poilievre are saying, we've got out of control immigration. It's those international students that are to blame for the affordable housing crisis. We've got to take those myths on because that's what they are. They're a bunch of myths that are meant to get us as working people to point the finger at people in our communities instead of pointing the finger at the government that divested themselves from a building affordable housing 30 years ago. So those are the kinds of conversations that I think need to happen. And that's the type of deep organizing that needs to happen. And we can't just sort of think that we can just put out a newsletter or put out a blog post and think that that's what's going to make the change. We've got to actually dive deep into the organizing in a real way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So really, it's a time to bring people towards deep organizing. Thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Gabby.
That was Dina Ladd from the Toronto Workers' Action Centre and Labour reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Gabby and Dina. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. For that, let's go to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news. On Wednesday, U.S. President Donald Trump unveiled a new, wide-sweeping tariff program. The new tariffs apply to nearly every country in the world, drastically raising the cost of imported goods in the U.S. Canada is already facing a 25% tariff on steel and aluminum. And Trump has also placed a 10% tariff on Canadian goods not covered by the free trade agreement with the U.S. Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg notes that there are few voices in the U.S. defending Canada against Trump's tariffs. Even some unions, like the United Auto Workers, have expressed their support of Trump's tariffs on Canadian-made cars and auto parts. There are, however, a few voices in the U.S. Senate working to oppose Trump. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia has put forward a bill to end all of the tariffs. With a Republican majority in the Senate, however, the likelihood of this legislation passing is slim. Staying in national news, in an op-ed on Rabble, Fareed Khan argues that Pierre Poilievre is not the right person to lead Canada during these troubled times. Poilievre has never had a career beyond being a federal MP. He also has refused to get a security clearance despite being leader of the opposition. He has also made many statements in support of Donald Trump, despite trying to distance himself from the U.S. president in recent weeks. Khan writes, quote, "Canadians need a leader rooted in reality, not one who fuels division and undermines the institutions that define our pluralistic society. Poilievre isn't just a risk, he is someone with the wrong stuff for the job." End quote. In environmental news, Greenpeace has recently been charged to pay over $600 million to a fossil fuel company in the U.S. Energy Transfer, the owner and operator of a pipeline in the U.S. state of North Dakota, sued Greenpeace for allegedly blocking and disrupting their pipeline in 2016 and 2017. In a column on Rabble.ca, David Suzuki argues that this is an example of a pro-fossil fuel judge using the legal system to suppress activists and free speech. Greenpeace was founded in Vancouver in 1971. And has been deeply involved with environmental and ecological issues for decades. And finally, the government of Alberta is backtracking after a decision was announced earlier this week that stops snacks and drinks from being provided to children fighting cancer. Alberta Health Services sent a notice to hospitals and other facilities stating that food would no longer be provided in non-inpatient areas. This was done, their memo reads, in the name of efficiency.
You're listening